All right, so we'll just start off with some more general questions, just so you get a sense as to who Brad is and some of the things that he's done. So, you know, Brad is the quintessential entrepreneur. So if you can just describe, what are the type of things you're doing right now?
Make sure this is working. Good. Hey, everyone. I live in Toronto, but I'm originally from the West, so I can identify with most of you. My wife actually was from Winnipeg. She went to U of M. Most people thought University of Michigan, but that's University of Manitoba. So for most of my life, I was the real Santa Claus. I just didn't have as big a beard or the belly, but I was a toy maker from the North. And I shipped billions of pieces of plastic around the planet to put smiles on kids' faces. Most recently, I exited that about a year and a half ago, and now I have a company in Hong Kong called Indico, which is an accelerator, and it's specifically an impact accelerator. So what that means is that we find really smart entrepreneurs who have got a idea and a really clever strategy. They've got product market fit, but they just lack the ability to scale it, don't have the operations capacity or maybe experience to be able to build a world-class team. So we invest into those companies and help them get to market. And the first company we invest into is a company called Pila.
So I've got a question.
Oh, okay.
That's good. You know, I was telling Brad, you know, it might take a while for the crowd to warm up, start firing those questions in, but I have one. In fact, it was a question I was thinking of just emphasizing. So what are the toys? So maybe just get back to the toys, and then we'll see how many people may recognize the toy or maybe have brought some of those toys with them or have played with them.
Yeah, no, I didn't bring my bag of toys, the sled. Left that at home. But in the word of sleds, we actually made sleds. We're Canadians, so we know winter better than most. You in Winnipeg know it especially well. So if you ever went to Costco and you saw a sled that was being sold that was either a Ski-Doo or Polaris branded GT Snow Racer inspired, that was our toy. Lite-Brite, probably played with that before. My Little Pony, the ponies that are retro.
Maybe we could do, let's say, like the Little Pony. Is that the one you mentioned?
Yeah.
Can we do by a show of hands? Who here is Little Pony?
I'm concerned about all these people playing with My Little Pony. Oh, no, you did. Okay, got it.
That was pretty I mean, people don't want to lift their hands too high. That's what I was getting at.
Yeah, and our most probably prolific toy was the product called Mashems. These were little collectible licensed characters we licensed with Disney, Nickelodeon, Cartoon Network, and made these little characters that were filled with water, squishy, and they came in a capsule, and we sold over 300 million of those globally, and over, I think, 100 billion YouTube unboxing videos, so, yeah.
So how many? 100?
100 billion views on YouTube of unboxing videos.
Yeah, see, well, you know, when I first met Brad, when he rattled off some of these numbers, I almost had to do a double take. I haven't met many people who've actually sold 300 million toys.
Right.
So that's a lot of volume. That's obviously sold all over the world.
Globally, yeah, over to 180 countries.
So here's a question. So in terms of the toys, now, did you invent those toys, or what was the uniqueness?
Well, it depends on where we're going to go, because initially we were toy distributors, and then we pivoted our business to become toy manufacturers back in 2008. And yeah, the answer is we invented the concepts. Oftentimes we partnered with entertainment brands through licensing to leverage like what a Spider-Man or a My Little Pony or these other brands out there, but it was our invention.
Mm-hmm. And so obviously, maybe describe why you did the licensing. Maybe it's obvious, but in terms of a growth strategy, so you've invented toys, and then you obviously thought it was more valuable to pay a licensing fee, get the brand recognition, and...
Yeah, and I think it was a timing thing, too. I mean, that was a time in the toy world where licensing was on growth. But I would also say it's easier to borrow equity from somebody else's brand than it is to build a brand. Building a brand is hard, and maybe a little easier now with the access to social media channels, but it's a very expensive endeavor historically. Requires, you know, traditional model requires a lot of marketing, and marketing in a traditional sense is millions of dollars advertising in traditional media like TV. Today, the internet's changed that for sure, but licensing was a way to bypass that.
And then how many toys are successful? Like, in other words, how many toys get launched into the market? and actually get some traction?
Very few.
Yeah.
This is the quintessential probably point of this discussion, is that it's about failing your way forward. And in the toy business, it's a feast or famine business. I mean, how many people remember a product called Zuzu Pets? These were these little mice that went around cages. Do you guys recall? Did your kids ever get that or ask you for it? Okay, I see somebody nodding their head. So the company that invented that, when they invented that product, they were a $10 million enterprise. The next year, they were $600 million. 3 years later, they were back to $10 million. So trying to build a business model and scaling a company and staff it properly, that's a bit challenging. And so it's, yeah, I will say to people, it's not for the faint of heart. And there's a lot of tries and most fails and a handful of successes. On average, one in every 10 toys for us was worthwhile. The rest were write-offs. And the key was to learn to fail fast.
Mm-hmm. And then how many years were you in the toy business?
25 years in toys.
So 25 years, and even after 25 years, your success rate with toys is 1 out of 10.
Yeah, I think it's, your success rate improves only because you start to fail faster. You start to understand patterns, try things that when you quickly see that they're not working, you cut bait quickly. So, you know, Jim Collins has this concept called bullets before cannonballs, and we definitely would fire bullets, and once in a while we would unleash the cannon because it worked, but oftentimes we just cut and run.
Mm-hmm. So to get back to what you're doing now, so you had the toy business, and then recently you got out of that. So maybe describe how you exited that business and then how you're transferring those entrepreneurial skills to new endeavors.
So do you want me to go back and talk about the failure to get to the toy business to the
sure.
exit?
Okay. Sure.
Since this is about adversity, let's talk about some adversity. Although I cannot compete, okay? When I heard that story, I was mind blown. Yeah, Diane's story is incredible. I would honestly say that if money can solve your problems, you don't have a problem. Although in the entrepreneur world, we all know that the big, dark, ominous thing called bankruptcy is probably our greatest fear. Like, everything that you, when you burr the company into the marketplace, I say to my wife, like, the kids will always be closer to you than me because you brought them into this world. I'm their father, and I support you, and I love them, but they're just going to be a different bond that you have. Not either good or bad or indifferent, it's just the way it is. Well, the business was my baby, and I birthed that into the world. So I'm going to skip a lot of the details, but I bootstrapped a company from Red Deer, and I was super proud of the fact that we were from Red Deer when all our competition was in Toronto, and we celebrated that for a long time. And we became the largest toy distributor in Canada by the early 2000s. The distribution business model is challenging because you're buying goods, paying for them up front, put them on the water, and then you ship them to retailers who take 90 days to pay you. So to try and grow that business, you need a lot of cash. It just stretches your cash continually. And we had been spectacularly good at growing our way out of problems. And quite frankly, it wasn't because we were good. We were just lucky. We just, you know, we'd continue to just roll this thing forward. And along the way, actually, had raised about $1 million of friends and family money because they wanted to get on the train because it was going somewhere. But in 2006, we hit a wall, and we found out the hard way that you can grow too fast, and uncontrolled growth is dangerous. Growing a company, you know, there's this dichotomy. You're either green and growing, or you're ripe and rotting, so that's certainly part of it. But secondly is when you grow a business, you stress it. You're absolutely stressing that business, and you're breaking it. And if you're not willing to feed it, you know, when you go to the gym and you work out, you break down your muscles, and then you got to go eat some protein to feed it. Well, your business is no different. If you're growing it, you're breaking things, and if you're not prepared to invest and feed it, you're going to run into problems. And we did. And so we may go back and talk about some of that stuff, but specifically, we went into bankruptcy as a way to restructure the company and try and fix it. We attracted about $3.5 million of outside investment for the restructuring. It would only come in if we restructured the company. That was, that dark word that I didn't want to enter into, but what I found is it wasn't as bad as I thought, truly. I mean, the bark is definitely much worse than the bite, but it is. I also came to appreciate that we live in a society that allows for fresh starts, that bankruptcy actually is a gift for, there's places in the world where if you can't pay your debts, they put you in jail for the rest of your life, Like, thank God we don't have that problem here, right? And then we wrestled for 2 years to try and save that company, but the problem was the model was broken. I didn't surrender to the fact that the business was fundamentally broken, and I was trying to add more money to fix it. And growth sugarcoats your problems, and money amplifies them. So when you have a broken business model and you add more money, you just make it more of a problem. And after 2 years of wrestling to save this company, primarily because I was motivated to pay back my friends and family the $1 million that was lost when we went into bankruptcy, which that makes very interesting Christmas dinner conversations. It's, yeah, a lot of fun. Going back to Red Deer is always a challenge. So, you know, we were highly motivated to try and fix it, but we just came to this point of surrendering that this no longer was a valid way to go forward. And so it forced us to pivot and to go from being a distributor to a manufacturer to stop. Our inventory buildup was massive. That was a big part of it. We'd overspent in development, had too much CapEx. Anyways, we fundamentally changed the model and went into manufacturing in 2008. And that was the beginning of what got us to the exit, which happened about a year and a half ago, mm-hmm. which was also not, as I said to Rick, it was a sudden exit with a soft landing, but it was not prescribed by me.
Okay. Do you want to describe how that came about? And
well, if you bring on financial partners in your venture, you've agreed to sell your company. That's the reality. So you go raise capital, you are headed for an exit at some point in your future. And most people's time horizon is 5 to 7 years. So when I raised the capital back in 2008 to start the new venture, so that I could repay the 3.5, so I could repay the $1 million of friends and family. So I just wanted to show you that I didn't actually want to make money. I just wanted to get out of pain, quite frankly. But we had agreed to figure out an exit. So my partners were increasingly putting on pressure that, hey, this thing's growing, it's working, you figured out a model, okay, it's scaling, we want to exit. So we had tried to sell the company twice, went through due diligence, and they never came to a deal for various reasons. But in the end, I architected a merger with a U.S. company. And it was a merger of equals, and the plan was merge these two companies together. We're going to do a roll-up, and the goal was to hit $1 billion in revenue. That was the vision, and we were going to do that over a period of 10 years between the two firms. And I found out the hard way that if you don't have cultural alignment, we heard about values and the importance of that. If you don't have the same values, you will not, it won't last. The foundation's broken. And certainly that was very, very clear with this new company that we merged with out of the gate. We just were, we were pretty much at each other the entire time just because we had different philosophies of leadership and how we were to scale the company. And so the board, I went from being a majority shareholder in my company to a minority in the new company. And because of the conflict, the board elected that I should be exited. And, you know, my reflection on that is that, you know, sometimes God saves you from what you want to give you what you need. I wanted to build a $1 billion company. That's what I thought. And looking back now, almost a year and a half, and it's funny, we were kind of talking about this over lunch. This is like the best thing that's ever happened to me. Like I had no idea that there was a better opportunity waiting for me by just living in faith that, okay, God, I don't understand where we're at. I don't understand why we're here, but I'm going to trust that there is a better outcome on the end of this. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened back in 2008. I went from a distribution company that I thought this was my baby, this is the best could be. And if it hadn't hit that adversity and we were able to turn it to our advantage with that pivot in 2008, I never would have known there was a better future. So, you know, there's, I fundamentally believe, you know, for us to be human, there's things we need to live a life of abundance. And you need to eat, sleep. You know, you need water, oxygen, you need companionship, and I would add to that list struggle. That your true value will only get realized by the adversities, that storms of perfection that come into your life. If there's only sunshine, you get only desert. And so the thing that I've come to surrender with in my life is that, okay, God, I don't understand why we're in this spot, and quite frankly, I don't like it, but I'm going to trust you that you're leading this and there's going to be a better opportunity that comes as a result of the adversity.
Mm-hmm. So just to scroll back to how you got started in business. So given your entrepreneurial passion, it seems that you were almost geared to be an entrepreneur, and yet you didn't start off down a typical entrepreneurial path.
No, so I'm the son of a chiropractor, and he's the son of a chiropractor, as both my grandfather and grandmothers are chiropractors, and my great-grandfather was the first chiropractor in Denmark. So this is like this thing you're supposed to do. So from the time I was this big, I was told, you're going to be a chiropractor. And, I went to school to be a chiropractor, actually. And it was actually during... The best thing that came from going to school is I met my wife, who was at U of M, but then transferred to Red Deer College, thank God. And some of you are thinking, what a downgrade, but it was a good thing for me. But I always had an entrepreneurial spirit. I would say at a young age, my first business I can remember was a wood cutting business when I was 16. I used to look in the paper, see what they were selling a cord of wood for. It was $65. And I'm like, you know what? My dad's truck, his chainsaw, can split it. Okay, I'm going to sell for $60. And we were busy. And I basically funded my entire outdoor pursuits and adventures by that. And it was just something that I always loved and believed in. And actually, sort of the first kickoff was when I was, like, I would say transformational was when I was 19. I got into network marketing. And while I don't subscribe to that business today, what I will say, the exposure of being a lifelong learner, listening to tapes, reading books, going to seminars like this, getting around mentors, just deciding that to be my best, I had to work for it. Nothing worth doing comes easy. You have to invest in yourself. It's the best investment you can make. So those were kind of my entrepreneurial roots.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a question, just to clarify, I think you did indicate that you paid back the original $1 million. There was a
Yes, we did.
Yeah, so you can go to Red Deer now or not?
No, yeah, well, yeah. So my family still lives in Red Deer, and my wife and I joke about it. It's still awkward. Look, there's shame. So much of our worth is built into being successful in business, but there's just a sense of shame about it. But I guess it's just because we beat up ourselves. I listened to and I highly recommend it, J.K. Rowling's Harvard commencement speech on YouTube. Watch it. She talks about the adversity before she created the Harry Potter franchise, which now makes her the wealthiest woman in the UK. But one of the statements that's in there that's incredible is she gets to this place where she's completely broken, like she's got nothing left. But she says she had her son, she had a typewriter, and she had her creative skills. And she said, as it turns out, rock bottom happens to be a great foundation to build from. And I just thought, what an awesome way to frame it. Most people would, the quote by Hemingway that the world breaks all of us, most of us are stronger in the broken places, not all of us, because breaking bone, when it does heal, is stronger than before it was broken, but if it doesn't heal properly, it gets gangrenous. So there is a difference, right? You can choose to be broken, or you can choose to be better. It's your choice on how you look at the circumstance. Coming back to family, probably one of the greatest days of my life, and I tell you, there's a lot of tears shed, was sitting down and writing checks to people unexpectedly, because they're business people. They invested. Not all your investments go up. And we didn't have to, quite frankly. But it was just something my wife and I said, we want to make this right when we have the ability to do it. And it gave me such incredible joy those days to be able to go out for coffee with them. That was part of the history. And at the end of the coffee, just slide a check across and just the floodgates open up. It was awesome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's great. Now, in terms of your start in Red Deer and looking back on your growing up years and how your faith developed, how would you describe the role of faith in this whole journey?
Well, okay, so I was raised in a Christian home, but I took it for granted. And quite frankly, I was not good at taking orders. I think a lot of, when I picked my value, independence was high. It was in my top three. And being told by my parents I need to go to church and believe in Jesus and all that was like, okay, thanks. I need to go figure this out for myself. So I'm so grateful now that I had that foundation when I look back on it. And, you know, for me, probably one of the most transformational parts of my youth is right after high school, I was kind of done with school for a while, so I wanted to travel. And my dad said, you know, why don't you go check out this YWAM thing? So I did a DTS, so YWAM's Youth of the Mission, and they do outreaches. And I went there, and I was pretty skeptical, to be honest. I thought, okay, well, at least I get to do some traveling, meet some cool people, and this will be a fun adventure. But I came away with that, with just a great foundational, just a great foundation to be able to, you know, move my creed forward. The first is that I understood the value of being a Canadian. So when I traveled outside of Canada and I started to see how the rest of the world was, I was like, wow, I won the lottery. In fact, as of today, if you're part of the 37 million people who have the privilege to live in this country, that's less than 0.5% of the planet's population. So that on its own is an incredible piece of gratitude. Secondly is living in faith, which I'd really never done, but one of the things that they do in YWAM is they, you know, you go there, you don't really know which country you're gonna go to, you don't know any of the details. It's all kind of, as you go, you're praying about it and you're saying, God, direct us. And literally, I mean, there was days we didn't know where we're gonna be sleeping, where we're gonna be eating, and it just was unbelievable to see God continually show up and provide in another country. And the third was that it's better to give than receive. The joy you get from making impact into someone else's life can never be replaced by anything that you could ever buy. And so at an early age, that became grounding and really influenced the rest of my, I would say, business life. That being said, I'd be lying to you to say that I didn't let my business become my idol, for sure. If you looked at my calendar and my priorities, my initial company was completely consumed by me, and I was the kind of guy that I'd work longer and harder than anybody else. The second business, after I had the wake-up call, and I will say one of the things I glazed over and didn't really dive into is that during that era of going through the bankruptcy and turmoil, it, when things are out of control in your life, what grounded me was taking control of what I could. So focusing on my fitness, getting back to basics with my prayer life and devotions. I remember reciting Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 over and over again. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will guide your paths. And the serenity prayer. You know, God, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. To change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So those just become mantras for me. And I would say, again, there's been no sort of like one time where suddenly I broke free from, I'm human. You know, I feel like I'm in an AA meeting. I am a human. I built a company and, you know, I've made my fair share of mistakes. I overworked. I've, you know, done a lot of things that I think probably may have helped the business, but didn't help my spirituality or my family. But, you know, the thing I've come to sort of surrender to is that when you're driving a car, you have to constantly turn in the wheel to stay on the road. So I don't really believe that there's such thing as balance. I think there's just awareness of imbalance. You know, like, I'm going down the road, I need to turn the wheel to get more online. I got to turn the wheel to get more online, unless you're traveling through Saskatchewan, that's just a straight line.
And then how would you describe your sense of calling today in terms of what drives you, your sort of sense of purpose, sense of mission?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely changed. So I've spent a bunch of time after I exited the company. I had some time, which is unusual for me because I don't like to sit still for long. But I had some time. It gave me a chance to kind of reflect on my future and kind of going back, what are my values? What do I want my legacy to be? Asking those really important questions. And I would actually say part of the process has been being a part of ELO. Last year, going to Oxford. There's a plug for Oxford. We can talk about that. But I don't know how you guys feel, but I had this like almost guilt of being an entrepreneur and being a successful business person. In our culture, I think it's kind of like if you're not in ministry, you're kind of doing second best. You know, like you either are in ministry or you're not. And the Oxford experience exposed me to God's calling for entrepreneurs. And then reading a book by Jordan Rayner called Call to Create, which I highly recommend, was also, I think it gave me just this incredible sense of like serenity that, wow, I really am living with my gift. So, you know, if you go back to the Genesis 1 account of creation, I think there's two things that God's fundamentally doing when he's creating. The first is that he's taking chaos and turning it to order. And the second thing is he's taking the void and he's filling it with creation, right? So you go through the 6 days of what happens, and that's what he's doing. And then he creates man, and the mandate to man is, he says, subdue the earth and fill it. So subdue the earth, take it from chaos to order, continue to do the work that I've done, and fill it. Well, it was already pretty full. I mean, lots of trees and birds and animals and stuff like that. I mean, it was full. But what is he talking about? Co-create with me. In other words, I don't know that we're physically look like God when we're in creating God's image. I think it's more that we are to act like God and to be caretakers for his creation and to live every day a life of abundance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I feel like my calling is really, certainly this new venture that I'm involved in, it's we're making phone cases, which sounds very unexciting relative to toys, but just so happens the phone case market's a $20 billion industry annually, which I thought was shocking. But the phone cases are made out of corn from the U.S. and flax from Manitoba. And it's true. Yeah. We buy our flax from Manitoba. And they biodegrade. And really, it's, I got to tell you, after shipping billions of pieces of plastic around the planet, all putting smiles on kids' faces, you know, noble intent. I feel pretty, you know, this is like my John Newton moment, right? So John Newton, the story of the slave trader who, you know, in the storm, suddenly falls on his knees and says, God, if you save me from this, I will dedicate my life to you. And the storm surpasses, and he follows up on his commitment. He goes back to London, works with Wilberforce, and he's responsible for helping eliminate the slave trade in the British Empire, which is an incredible story. So this is my John Newton moment. I have an opportunity to kind of make some recompense for the plastic that you now see floating in the oceans. And but I'm a big believer. God gave us the creativity to solve our problems.
Yeah.
And I think that entrepreneurs, you know, to me, the Elon Musks of this world should be Christians. Christians should be leading that. They should be coming up with the biggest and best solutions for our planet because God commissioned them to do that.
You know, that's such a key point. And one of the things that we always stress at ELO is, and what I've got in my books is, you know, God is a creator. We're created in his image. We're creative beings. When you're involved in creativity, you're involved in a divinely inspired process. So you're probably no closer to God than you'll ever be when you're involved in the creative process. And so when you're doing entrepreneurial, innovative things, that's divinely inspired. And it's interesting that Ray talked about, he just touched on the fact that people don't understand the Christian contribution to the nonprofit sector. If you look at the history of social entrepreneurship, which just means applying social innovations in a nonprofit context, Christians have led the way for thousands of years, going back to the time of the Roman Empire, going back to the days of Victorian England. If you look at a bit before that with the Methodists, with John Wesley, the number of innovations he came up with, the first dispensary of medicine, he gave loans to church members. If you look at D.L. Moody, the great American evangelist in the 1800s, they called him the prophet of innovation, the prophet meaning P-R-O-P-H-E-T. You know, if you think that the idea of having a church in a movie theater is a new idea, D.L. Moody was doing that in 1893 during the time of the Chicago World's Fair. And then if you look at 1946, it was a Mennonite lady in Pennsylvania, Ruth Edna Byler, who originated the concept of fair trade. But how many people would know that? Fair trade is a Christian concept. So there's this massive history of divinely inspired creativity in the Christian sector. It's interesting you refer to Jordan Rayner. So I've connected with him on the phone. He's actually our keynote. He'll be a speaker at our conference in Toronto, to be confirmed, but 95% of the way there. So it's not on our website, but he's written a great book, call to create, and his last name is Raynor, R-A-Y-N-O-R. It's a great book. So just a a few more questions in terms of the spiritual lessons that you've learned. So, you know, often people think Christians, you know, when you're in business, you know, if God blesses you, you know, like the fact that you're successful, God blesses you. If you're unsuccessful, that somehow you're not blessed. And so, you know, we often hear this combination of, you know, how are you doing? Oh, you know, and you hear this great phrase, oh, the Lord's blessed me tremendously. Well, you don't assume the guy's bankrupt. You assume, oh, I made a ton of money, i.e. God blessed me. So in your situation, like how would you explain that to people that the financial success is not commensurate with your spirituality?
Prosperity gospel, I think, is you're referring to, and I would say I do not subscribe to that at all. What was it? I think Winston Churchill said, success is going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. And if you know anything about his early life, you know he had a lot of failures. And I think that's part of why he was the man who was able to do what he did during that time in history. If you go back through biblical antiquity at all the heroes that we talk about, they all went through incredible adversity. They failed over and over again. They weren't failures. To me, there's a difference. Failing is normal. That's human. I mean, when you were a baby learning to walk and you fell down the ground, you say, ah, that's it. I give up. I'm not walking anymore. I mean, that was a failing, right? But you did it over and over again until you eventually were able to walk. Same thing with riding a bike. When you get knocked down and stay down, then you become a failure. So I'm a big believer in failing. And you go back and you look at, you know, let's go to Moses. You know, he argued with God about why he shouldn't lead the Israelites out of Egypt, right? He was a coward. He murdered an Egyptian. And he goes down to be the author of most of the Old Testament, the guy who was gifted the Ten Commandments to bring them down from the mountain, right? Joseph, a braggart, a punk, gets sold into slavery, gets betrayed by Potiphar's wife. Despair, right? Failing over and over again. Becomes the second most powerful man in Egypt and saves his family. King David, the man after God's own heart, right? We all know his story. Chased down by Saul for most of his life, lived as a renegade, you know, and then eventually becomes the king. And then when he becomes the king, he, you know, has an affair with Bathsheba and kills her husband and da-da-da-da-da. So the point is that failing is human. It's a part of who we are and what we do. And so I don't believe in the prosperity gospel. I believe that we shouldn't be masochists in going to seek failure, but I think it's an important part of your learning in the value you create and who you are. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, Romans 3:5-5 says, rejoice in your sufferings, for suffering brings perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. And that's actually a really simple statement, but it's profound if you think about it, right? The suffering creates perseverance, character, and that character is what gives us hope. And I think God's laid out a formula, right? This is how you become fully human. Going back to what I said, eat, sleep, drink, struggle. It's a part of becoming who you are.
One last set of questions. You know, one thing I've had Christian business leaders say to me is that the best impact they can have in the marketplace is to be excellent at what they do, the pursuit of excellence. So how do you factor that into your own life in terms of, you know, I know you spend a lot of time on self-development, going to conferences and learning and improving, but why is that important, not just from a secular self-improvement type of approach, but rather from a spiritual standpoint that it's important to be excellent at what you do?
I think our excellence glorifies God. At the end of my life, I want to be laying on my deathbed. Well, I heard this great quote. I don't know if you saw George Bush do his father's eulogy, but he said, my father said to die young as late as possible. I subscribe to that. I'm a big kid. I do want to die young. But I want to lay in my deathbed, and I want to know that I left all of it behind on the field of life, that there's nothing that I could have or should have done. I remember my father told me at an early age, you know, in life you're going to pay one of two prices, the price of discipline or the price of regret. That haunted me. It still haunts me, to be honest. I don't want to regret anything. I don't want to go back in my life and say, I wish I would have done that. I want to know that I tried it, and maybe I failed. Maybe it didn't work out, but I learned from it, and I advanced forward, because the pursuit of excellence is about that. It's about getting outside of your comfort zone. Quite frankly, that's where life begins. Life begins on the edge of your comfort zone, and in fact, bring somebody with you, and it's magic. So that's, I guess, where, you know, two of more of you are gathered that want to step outside your comfort zone together to try and grow and stretch yourself. I honestly believe that's truly living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing I'll mention just in closing is that Brad referred to this program in Oxford. So one thing that ELO does is we have something called the Entrepreneurial Leaders Program, which is a one-week sort of executive education program at the University of Oxford in collaboration with Wycliffe Hall. And we had 25 Christian business leaders from literally around the world right out to Singapore and different parts of Asia. And this year we've got different people coming in from Hong Kong, Singapore, US, Canada, and Europe. And Brad was part of that. So if you have any questions about that, you can ask Brad. There's also Larry and Sylvia Dick are in the room, and they attended last year. And there's information at our table in the exhibit area. And I'd like to thank Brad for his participation. Thanks.